problems.
I believe it's actually going to work. So you left Sperry Rand in 61, and you were unemployed for a little while.
No, I knew I was going with Richard.
Oh, you did? So you had that in the plans already?
Yeah, that's why I left, because I wanted to go.
Okay. Now, what was the institute at that time?
It was mostly Dick and me and a couple of other women who he felt sorry for and wanted to give a job. And so they did, you know, somewhat interesting things, but they didn't have any professional training that made them good researchers or good documentalists or good anything else.
Was it in Philadelphia or in Bethesda?
He was still in New York when I joined him, but he, when I said I would go with him, but he said then he would move his office, and he moved it to Bethesda at first because he was working on the same things with Milton Lee that I was working on, and he thought that might be convenient. But then I said, well, I don't want to have to commute to Washington every day. And I don't want to stay down in Washington. I have a family and I want to go home. And he said, well, then I guess the only solution is to move the office to Philadelphia. So he moved the office to Philadelphia to accommodate me. Hmm.
Now, who was funding the institute?
Just grants that we took from, well, and there was somebody's widow. I don't remember her name anymore, but it was some famous scientist who died, or I think he was an MD, and she had his money, and she was doling it out to whoever she thought was worthy, and Dick was one of the people who thought so the founding of the Institute was funded by her. If I just had my file, I could find all these names.
Now, what had he already had a reputation in some area?
Okay. Dick was a homosexual, and this made life tough for him in the granting business and all that kind of thing. And he never admitted it. He was a closet homosexual. But he was having trouble with other MDs and so on, and he'd been in the military, and I think he got a proper dismissal from the military, but he was, I don't know, just battered by the attitude toward homosexuals at the time. And he was sort of obviously homosexual in the sense that he would put his arm around a guy when he was walking beside him or something like that. And, I mean, he wasn't sissy-ish, but he was a slight build and so on. And so anyhow, he was the object of a lot of discrimination that he didn't deserve at all, but he was a brilliant guy. And he trained to be an MD, and he was an MD, and then he couldn't succeed in practice right off, and so he went into research, which is where he belonged, and did hormone and adrenal gland research, and was successful at it, but then he went into the military. And when he came out of the military, he wanted to do something different. He wanted to be in business for himself and do research of some kind, and so he decided on this medical communication, because it was coming to the fore, and the EMA and various places were talking about, you know, getting into the game and trying to do communication better, and that led him to, you know, start working with the AMA and working on other. He was interested in methodology more than anything else, the things that people just took for granted and went on and made assumptions about. He wanted to test the assumptions, and he wanted to do it properly with scientific method. And so that was what made him tick. And he was interested in teaching me how to do scientific work better than I had ever done it. I'd written papers, but I hadn't really used scientific method in making determinations. And so he taught me good research methods and turned me loose and let me write papers, and then he'd rewrite them. I can show you an example of that with a FACET experiment. He said, write it up. So I wrote it up, and I had pages, and he took it and revised the whole thing and made it much more formal and gave more structure to it. And he was great at writing, and compared to me, certainly he was, and made everything as objective as possible. So he did a number of methodologic studies that I think will have more significance as time goes on. I can't understand why he's not famous.
He's still quoted extensively in the evaluation literature.
Is he?
Yeah.
Well, he should be. He should be.
I was given his paper on the goodness of library services in my first year as a doctoral student and said, read this, memorize it.
Really?
Uh-huh. And,
that was his forte. He was excellent at it. And he was such a lovely man. He was wonderful to work with. And I really enjoyed my years with him.
Mm-hmm. But now, working there, you were dependent upon getting your own funding then.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so your big project there was with Medlars then. Is that right?
Who got the money for that? I didn't get it personally. I guess the Institute got that money. But no, I was also getting money from... Drexel was teaching the whole time, and that was going through Dick. And Dick did me a big favor there because I was an adjunct visiting professor of information science or something. And I didn't give a darn when anybody called me. I was doing the same thing no matter what the name was. And Dick said, well, they're not going to call you that, or else you're not going to be there. So he went over and talked to Dr. Harvey about it. And Dr. Harvey acquiesced the very first meeting. Dick came out of there and says, you're now an assistant professor of information science. Well, I said, okay. So he cared about discrimination of any kind, and he thought I was being discriminated against. And I'm pretty sure my money from Drexel was going through him to pay my salary. I was one salary. And what was my other big fund? Federation. Had funding from
that
NIH.
Kept on from Sperry right on through.
Yeah, they kept right on.
So once you had done that one big project for them in 62, I think that was?
Well, I had started in 60 or 61, and it went on through 63.
60, okay. So they kept funding
over the
3-year time, huh?
Yeah, but they in turn were being funded by NIH. It was just being passed through.
And so Medlars, your work there started from the director.
It started from that Astia meeting where I got up and shut off my mouth, and then went through Sperry Rand to the point where we bid on the Medlars contract but lost the bid, and then I started to tell you that the reason Brad Rogers wanted me to be it. Part of the Medlars thing was that GE had this machine, the 225 and the 250 and so on, computers that they were developing, and had worked with Western Reserve trying to get installed and so on. And it became obvious that they were interested in this contract because they'd never done a retrieval contract in their lives. And here they were doing Medlars. How they got it, I still don't know. But one of the guys who'd been at UNIVAC with me was now on the GE team, and that was an interesting development. But he hadn't done information retrieval at Rembrandt. He'd done other stuff. So anyhow, GE had the contract, and it was pretty clear that they would suggest their own machine. They work things so that when the time came to decide what machine to get, it was going to be the GE machine. So Dr. Rogers felt like a sitting duck in that respect and was leery about the fact that they had never done a retrieval project before in their lives. And the people at Medlars didn't know of Seymour Tain being the outstanding contradiction to this. Didn't know anything about applying machines. I mean, he had been had a lot of punch card right at the National Library. He'd had a lot of punch card experience by this time, but he didn't know anything about computers. And so they felt that the National Library staff was ignorant of computers, and the computer people were ignorant of information retrieval, and they needed a go-between. And so when the time came to recommend what machine we're going to have, Seymour Tain sat behind me and kept kicking me in the butt through the opening in the chair in the seat where I was, and saying under his breath, keep it keep it down, you're going to win, keep it down, you're going to win. I mean, I hadn't said anything yet, but it was time for me to get up and make my speech, which I had spent 6 months preparing, about why some other computer was to be chosen for the project rather than the GE. And all the GE brass were there to hear this. And it was...
You were supposed to make a pitch for the GE machine?
No. I was to make my own pitch.
Univac. Uh-huh.
No. They thought I'd pitch Univac, and I didn't. I didn't.
Okay.
It was the Minneapolis Honeywell 800 or some such number that I recommended, because I, you know, took everything into consideration, went one step at a time, and said why this wouldn't do and why that wouldn't do, and it had to be this or that. And I did it, I think, a darn good job, I mean, judging it myself. And Seymour was very, very pleased when I was finished. And so was Brad Rogers. I prevailed. They took the machine
Used the machine that you recommended.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Huh. And so, you know, I was a go-between all the time. I mean, if NLM people didn't know what the GE people were saying, I'd translate and vice versa.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I felt like I had a very important role to play in Medlars, even though it's not very well advertised.
And so your central role was in the decision about what equipment to use.
Well, not only that, but... every little thing that came down the line, about how many questions you had to be able to handle at one time in order to meet the need.
Uh-huh.
How this would ever be ready to go online if we decided to go online. Uh-huh. We had to go talk to those Frenchmen who were making the Photon and tell them how they had to make another machine that would handle titles in every language, so that you had, you know, umlauts and cedillas and all those things available to you, so you could print anything you needed to print. There was no machine then that would do that. You know, there was just something every moment that needed some arbitration between NLM and GE.
You must have done this somewhere between here, that is in Lyon, Lexington, Philadelphia, and Washington.
I went to Washington 3 days a week during 1962 because I was president of ADI. I was on the Medlars project. I was teaching at NIH. I forget why I was chosen to do that teaching, but and I forget what I was teaching, but I know I had to go there once a week. And there was, I was active on Astia too. But there was still another thing I thought of yesterday that I was doing. So I was in Washington 3 days a week during that period, and I shared an apartment with a woman that I'd met, and would just stay there and come back and forth just once. Oh, I was teaching at Drexel, that was the other thing. And so I had to, on Friday nights, I had to catch a particular plane and get home in time to teach my Friday night class at Drexel or else. And there were several people from Philadelphia, from the Auerbach Corporation, that were going to Washington as frequently as I was. And they'd see me coming, and they'd say, Claire, do you have a ticket, or are you on standby? And I'd say, standby. And they'd say, don't worry, you can have my ticket if you need it. They'd get me home. And that was a really hectic life.
3 days a week.
Yeah.
Wow.
And doing different projects each time, you know, so I had to keep changing gears and working late hours and all that. And not being able to relax and be at home and be in somebody else's apartment.
Well, now, were you the major outside consultant?
I was the only one.
Oh, you were on the Medlars.
The one and only, yeah. I had that argument with Charlie Bourne this week. He's writing an article, and he said that, he didn't name who, but he said, of these five people, some were on Medlars, some were on this, and some were on that, but he didn't say who was on which. And I just wrote him a note and said, none of these people were at Medlars when I was there, and I was there for those 3 years, and I was the only consultant, so I'd like to know who's claiming to have been a consultant. I think it was Dake Gull, because Dake, I've seen things in print saying that he was a consultant to Medlars, but I don't know when or how.
Now, Winifred Sewell was on staff.
She was on staff.
Dealing with the vocabulary.
Right.
What was it like working with her?
I didn't work very much with her. She and I had worked together when she was at Squibb and I was at Merck Sharp and Dohme. We'd visit one another and compare notes and so on, and we had different ideas about how each of us wanted to do our work. But we respected one another, and we were both active in SLA together, and had mutual friends, and, you know, we always got on very well, except that we didn't completely agree on how things should be handled for our libraries. And then when she went to National Library, we still had that same sort of relationship, pretty much, that we had respect for one another, but we weren't going to get down to nuts and bolts kinds of things together. So I didn't actually work on the vocabulary at a nuts and bolts level.
So you did the machine consulting and...
And arbitration between NLM and GE was what I was into mostly. Arbitration in a technical sense,
right,
not in an administrative sense.
Who were the folks that GE hired to do this? Did they do it with their own staff?
They did it with their own staff, yeah. And none of them I had ever heard of before. But the guy who was leading it was a very competent person, except he just didn't know anything about information retrieval.
The funding came from NLM to the Institute for your salary during that time, basically. And what proportion of your time would you say you spent on?
Well, I think I averaged over the period. It was one day a week, but there were times where I was there 2 days a week.
How do you feel about Medlars in retrospect? Did it accomplish all the things you thought it was capable of doing?
For the time, it was leading the world. And I was very proud of it.
What about when Lancaster and those folks did their evaluations? Well, actually, wasn't the first evaluation done by, what's his name, who was dean at Indiana?
Bernie Fry?
Right, Bernie Fry.
Yeah, I kind of was on the sidelines at that time, and I thought they were a little off base, but I didn't get up very upset about it. And I don't think anybody else did. I don't think anybody else paid much attention to what they said.
Right.
Yeah.
And then Lancaster came in and later did an evaluation.
Yeah, he and I have always disagreed about everything.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Now, did he evaluate the batch-oriented portion or the online? I can't remember which.
I'm not sure, because I read them with my tongue in my cheek and forget it. I've never been impressed with what he does. But I think the real test was it was adopted all over the world. I mean, all these other countries started using
tremendously
it.
Tremendously successful.
Yes,
in terms of development.
You know, so I don't think it matters what some of these people say.
Were you still working with them by the time they started the batch-oriented processing?
I stopped in 64, just when Medlars, you know, the basic Medlars was finished.
Yeah.
So no, I never was there during the online period.
Online started when?
About 66, I'm
66.
Not sure.
Okay. Are there other projects at the Institute that I wasn't able to find specific ones?
You mean for me or for the Institute itself?
Well, for you.
For me?
Working at the Institute.
I think if you just look at my bibliography for the period and see what I was into, we compared indexing of authors with their peer group.
I saw that one.
And
mm-hmm.
I thought that proved something fairly interesting. And what else? Well, we made that index, scheduled the meetings and so on for FACET. And I was teaching. And Dick and I think, wrote several analytic papers together.
You all did a couple that I... Well, I only saw one that was on evaluation of indexing approaches. And...
Yeah, there was one where I had Drexel students do the same papers as authors as elementary school children and some other group.
Oh, yeah, I don't think I saw that one.
And that was fun to see how they compared with one another.
Oh, I remember seeing that.
We were trying to see, you know, who can index and what do you have to teach them in order to make indexers out of them.
Yeah, that was interesting. Back to the Cranfield studies. Now, you were doing the work, you all were doing the work on evaluation before, and you were doing your work on thesauri before the Cranfield studies. And when you read those, you didn't say, oh, yes, that's exactly the point I've been trying to make, or...
No, I just said, well, he's joined the group.
okay.
But I thought it was clever, some of it, you know, that business about... what's relevant and what isn't, and so on. I thought he handled that quite well, and I emulated him. I used his formulae and various things I did after that. Yeah, I appreciated that.
On recall and precision.
Yeah, recall and precision.
Look back up in your memory about the 50s in terms of the progress, lack of progress in information retrieval. What do you wish had not been lost that got lost along the way? Or emphases that looked promising that didn't pan out? What do you think about in retrospect?
Okay. My overall reaction to that question is that most of what disappeared should have disappeared. You know, everybody and his brother was in there trying something a little different from everybody else. And there was no concerted effort. There was no way to evaluate. And that's what Dick Orr was all about. You have to have methods to test things. You can't just say, mine is the best, and then get up in meetings and fight with one another about whether some detail of what was just spoken was worse or better than what you do. I mean, that's all we did. We bickered with one another constantly, and it was not productive. The bickering wasn't. There were people like at DuPont that I'm thinking of who had a lot of clout just because DuPont had a lot of money, and they would get up and tout their own approaches to things, most of which fizzled. And
this was in the area of chemical indexing, chemical nomenclature.
Right, and you know, and they make sweeping statements about how good their stuff was, and without substantiation. And I'm trying to think of the guy who went out of the country somewhere, went to South America or something after a while, and just disappeared. But he had a lot of clout for a while, and he was a real evangelist.
This isn't Dyson. This is not Dyson.
No, Dyson was never at DuPont, I don't think.
No, you're right. He went to work for...
No, I blank out names that I don't like, as well as some I do like, but this guy just disappeared. He was a terrible evangelist. I mean, I'm right, you should do it this way, it's the only way to do it. And he was doing that for 2 or 3 years, and he had these disciples who would quote him and, you know, use his terminology. I could find it for you. But I just assume not speak his name anyhow, because it's not fair for me to set myself up as a critic. But in response to your question, I think most of the stuff that disappeared should have disappeared, and I think most of the stuff that lived should have lived. I mean, I think it has there's a way of sorting these things out that in the end shows, you know, what are sound techniques and what are not sound techniques.
One of the things, thinking again back to this Barry Rand experience, and I just wondered if any of this was apparent while you were there, it was during those late 50s that the UNIVAC machine was essentially losing its dominance to the IBM machine. Mm-hmm. Was this obvious
It was obvious to UNIVAC, too.
Was it?
Yeah, and there was a strong reason for it, and that was that IBM was organized around selling, not around inventing. And they would take the ideas of other people, especially Remington Rand, market them, and market them far more successfully, because Rembrandt didn't have a marketing branch that was worth a pinch of salt. Mm. And that was the main difference between the two. And this is not my idea. This, I've seen this in print. I've seen it all sorts of places.
Oh.
Yeah, that, I mean, everybody just knew it. Those salesmen in their black suits and their silk ties and their starched collars and everything. Pete Loon used to even talk about that derisively and say, I have one of those coats and I keep it on a hanger in my office in case I need to put it on. But I don't put
the
it on
IBM
very often.
The IBM uniform, yeah.
Yeah, the IBM uniform. But the whole point behind the uniform was that they were out there to sell. And everything was, they were a sales organization, as I said, not a research organization. So they almost never came up with anything wonderful and new. And they were just taking ideas that other companies had not marketed nearly as successfully and making a success of it.
What strikes me is, are all of the machines and systems that were available in the 60s, and it's hard for me anyway to sort out the machines from the ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I was trying to get at, how does one see through that? And when you say what was retained, what, when you say what should have been retained, was retained, what mm-hmm. dominant ideas would you say
came
out of that period?
You've read about the 9900 index analyzer that Pete Loon worked on for Dyson and Perry. Mm-hmm. And he was using the Mortaub approach, the uniterm approach to doing this,
mm-hmm.
and it didn't work. And he was the first person to call it quits. He saw that it wasn't working, because first of all, Dyson's coding technique had lots of imperfections in it. It was so long, and Pete had to build a machine that went across the card instead of up and down the columns to accommodate it, and it was so unwieldy, and it just wouldn't work. So the 9900 fizzled too.
That was the Loon scanner, or
the Loon scanner. I'm sorry, the Loon scanner. I'm confusing two things. It was the 9900 that was the Taub type machine, and they were using that at DuPont, or that kind of concept for a machine at DuPont during their golden years, and it fizzled because it just wasn't up to doing the kind of searching that people needed to have done. And, you know, I knew that somehow inside myself the whole time, that is, you couldn't just say what documents pertain to this word, what documents pertain to that word, and then try to put two and two together in your own head after you saw the answers to that question.
Mm-hmm.
And so none of those machines ever succeeded, not for very long, and no matter how much money was behind them, even if it was DuPont money, and trying to sell it to everybody. And so the machines then, now it's getting to be different, because speed has made a huge difference in what can be done feasibly and what can't. But at the speed that machines worked at that time, the only feasible approach was one that was based on vocabulary control, because quick indexes were no solution to retrieval problems. They were okay for current awareness, if you were willing to sit down and look through all the words in the alphabetical list and say, hey, I'm interested in that. You know, but that was so tedious, and it wasn't answering what all is there on this set of terms. It wasn't answering that kind of question, so it was not a good retrieval approach to anything. And so everything fell away until the Medlars one sort of exemplified to me what was the best in all that had been developing during the 50s. This was now the early 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And
who would you say was responsible for the dominant approach, or the way Medlars decided to pursue their information retrieval program? In terms of an idea, the way to do information retrieval, whose ideas?
Well, I relate a lot of things back to Moores, who pushed the superimposed coding. I mean, meaning putting lots of punches in one card. Mm-hmm. It didn't have to be scrambled together like his random numbers were. Mm-hmm. But the idea is it should all be in one place to be cross-correlated. And I give him a lot of credit for that, although most of the world never heard of him or never paid attention to him. But he was a pioneer. And I considered myself a Moore's disciple, although Moore's tried to sue me a couple of times.
Oh, is that right? Stealing his ideas?
Yeah, in Merck, he said that I had taken his idea and put it to work, and that was a true statement. The trouble is, and he said he had it patented, the trouble is you can't patent an idea. You can only patent a demonstrable system. And I wasn't using his Seder cards or anything. There was no reason why I couldn't use the idea and put it on punched cards. And so, you know, we had our little scraps, but in the end, we were friends again.
He threatened to sue you or actually didn't serve papers?
In writing, in letters, correspondence, he threatened to sue me. And I took the letter to the patent department at Sharp and Dohme and said, what should I do about this? And he said, don't do anything. He has not got a leg to stand on.
I hope you kept those letters.
Yeah, they're in my file at Babbage.